Last week, I began a two-part series of commentaries, which I will complete today. If you missed it last week, all of my commentaries are archived and can be heard at www.tomjoyner.net. Last Monday's commentary was filled with information that is not taught in our schools and not exposed by a liberal mainstream media. I urge you to go to the archives and listen. www.tomjoyner.net. No doubt our liberal folks will accuse me of racism and Islamophobia, but I know my own heart, and so these false charges don't bother me. Truth is the best defense. And what you'll hear here in these two commentaries is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Those who take offense are simply too far left to see the road ahead. Now, to the second part of this two-part commentary. Why is Islam not compatible with American culture? Ask the people of Sweden, where Muslim rapes of Swedish women are increasing daily. Ask the people of Denmark, where Muslims they allowed into their country are demanding the right to marry children as young as 9. Muslims cite their different culture when making their demands for their host country to change its own culture to conform to theirs. Anyone desiring to come to America either knows our culture or should know it before entering. This is the United States of America, not Islam West. Why come here if you do not like our rules, our laws, and our customs? If you want to live under Sharia law, stay where you are. Don't come to our country and call for Sharia law. If your customs make women third-class citizens, just below cattle and sheep, why come here at all? If your customs call for you to beat women or kill them, why come here? If your God commands you to kill those of us who do not share your Islamic belief, why come here? When you feel your daughter has disappointed you, and that you somehow preserve your honor by killing her, why come here? There are many other differences between the rules, laws, and customs of America and those of Islamic countries. While we may not approve of the rules, laws, and customs of these Muslim countries, we do not move there and demand that they change to conform to us. To do so, of course, would bring death. Here, Muslims expect to make their demands with no adverse consequences. There comes a time when common sense has to prevail, and that time is now for the immigration of America by Muslims. Now, am I Islamophobic? No. I don't dislike Muslims, per se, but I have seen enough of their encroachment upon our rules, laws, and customs, and those of other non-Muslim countries, to be leery of their motives. While we are told that Islam is a religion of peace, the actions taken in the name of Islam are far from peaceful. Muslims have been at war continuously with non-believers for more than 1,400 years. Here is a rough estimate of the deaths of non-Muslims by the political act of jihad. In Africa, Thomas Sowell, a black author of Race and Color, estimates that 11 million slaves were shipped across the Atlantic and 14 million others were sent to the Islamic nations of North Africa and the Middle East. Yet, we are taught only about the Atlantic slave trade, which was much smaller and later than that of Islamic nations. For every slave captured by tribal leaders, many others died. Estimates of this collateral damage vary. The renowned missionary David Livingston estimated that for every slave who reached a plantation, blacks or whites, 5 others were killed in the initial raid or died of illness, and privation on the forced march to the coast. Those who were left behind were the very young, the weak, the sick, and the old. These soon died, since the main providers had been killed or enslaved. So for 25 million slaves delivered to the market, we have an estimated death of about 120 million people. Arabs ran the wholesale slave trade in Africa. The number of Christians martyred by Islam is 9 million. A rough estimate by Raphael Moore in his History of Asia Minor is that another 50 million died in wars by jihad. So counting the million African Christians killed in the 20th century, we have a total of 60 million Christians who were put to death. I find it odd that states led by Democrats keep suing in the courts to keep President Obama from stopping the influx of refugees from certain countries where the terrorists train, recruit, and plot against America. He's out now, but when he was in office, this was true. The six countries that he last proposed are extremely lax in record-keeping and security procedures, and that makes it very hard to identify and to vet people from those countries who seek entry into the United States. All the president proposed was to institute a temporary 90-day period where refugees from those countries are delayed entry into America while we develop better security measures to prevent terrorists among them from getting into the United States. This was not a ban on all Muslims or even a ban on Muslims from those named countries. There is nothing about it that deals with religion, but common sense and attacks of the past tell us clearly that most of the world's terrorism comes from Middle East countries who practice Islam. It's common sense to understand that our danger from terrorism has not come from Ireland or Scotland. Ask yourself about why Democrats work so hard to block any move that increases our security. Listen carefully to the facts I'm about to reveal that clearly show the danger of Islamic jihad. Kennard Elst, in his book Negative Nationism in India, gives an estimate of 80 million Hindus that were killed in a total jihad against India. The country of India is only half the size of ancient India due to jihad. The mountains near India are called Hindu Kush, meaning the funeral pyre of the Hindus. Buddhists do not keep up with the history of war. Keep in mind that in jihad, only Christians and Jews were allowed to survive as servants to Islam. Everyone else had to convert or die. Jihad killed the Buddhists in Turkey, Afghanistan, and along the Silk Route and into India. The total deaths are roughly 10 million. Oddly enough, there were not enough Jews killed in jihad to significantly affect the totals of the Great Annihilation. The jihad in Arabia was 100% effective, but the numbers were in the thousands, not the millions. After that, the Jews submitted and became servants and second-class citizens of Islam and did not have geographic political power. Egypt was 14.5 million people when first opened in Umar's time. When Napoleon walked in 1,000 years later, the country was down to 2.5 million people from 14.5 million. 1,000 years of bad management causing famines, ethnic cleansing, genocides, revolts, it all had taken its toll. And that happened to one of the world's most advanced civilizations of the time. 1,000 years, and instead of increasing, the 14.5 million people were reduced to 2.5 million. That speaks to the mentality of the Arab people. In 1979, I made my first of several visits to Israel as one of 12 journalists that were invited by the government to see firsthand what was happening in that part of the world. This was just after Israel had defeated a combined Arab force to take over the Golan Heights from Syria and the Sinai from Egypt. It was in the Sinai Desert that I saw firsthand the difference in how Arabs had dealt with this arid desert and how the Israelis dealt with it. Under Egyptian control, the Sinai was pretty much a barren wasteland, with sand piled as high and as far as the eye could see. When Israel captured the Sinai in the war, they set about to turn the desert green. Hot houses contained vegetables and fruit, and large swatches of desert were converted into greenery. The Arabs could have done the same thing, but they were content to let the desert be desert rather than put forth the effort to tame it. When we talk about ancestors, we must consider some of the various barbaric practices that were commonplace in their lives. We tend to look at them with a judgmental eye, thinking of them as uncivilized and downright savage. Most of us would even admit to wandering if our violent predecessors, like those who relished the bloody gladiator games or those who condoned cruel medieval torture chambers, were actually less evolved than those alive today. But has humankind really progressed that much? And are we just a bloodthirsty and relentless people as ever? If you're under the impression that we are somehow more enlightened, you might be surprised by some of the ancient barbaric practices that exist throughout the world. A woman in Papua New Guinea was stripped, tortured with a fiery iron rod, covered in gas, and burned alive on a mound of car tires in front of hundreds of onlookers, all for being a supposed witch. If it wasn't for the gas and car tires, you'd probably assume this happened in the 16th or 17th century, and not in February 2013. Like something out of the Salem witch trials, the perpetrators let mere hearsay convince them the 21-year-old woman was a witch, and they took revenge in a horrific fashion. Papua New Guinea isn't the only place that's still afraid of witches. Multiple societies in Africa still have a regular witch hunt, and it's not just isolated groups of people. For instance, Gambia's own president, Yahya Jammeh, who is admittedly a little crazy, launched a witch-hunting campaign in 2009 that terrorized the villagers, caused dozens to flee the country, and killed at least six people. Other examples in India, around 150 to 200 women were killed per year for witchcraft. And in Saudi Arabia, witchcraft is legally punishable by death. In modernized countries, we cringe at our ancestors' past use of slavery, yet talk ourselves into feeling less guilty by believing those days are long past. Unfortunately, they are not. The International Labor Association estimates that there are currently between 10 and 30 million slaves worldwide, more than at any other single point in history. You heard me right. There have never been more slaves than there are right now, even during the 18th century, the zenith of the African slave trade. At that zenith, there were only 6 million slaves transported out of Africa. Where are these slaves coming from? Well, pretty much everywhere. All across the globe, men, women, and children are abducted or tricked into capture and forced into debt slavery, the sex trade, and various other forms of exploitation. In the United States alone, there are an estimated 100,000 children trapped in the sex trade. Human trafficking worldwide has grown to a 30 billion-dollar business, and soon is expected to surpass the drug trade. Although no country is exempt from this crime, the bulk of slaves exist in Asia, where there are around 12.3 million people in forced labor. Those victims often go unnoticed as slaves because they work in plain sight in restaurants, agriculture, hotels, and similar industries. Meanwhile, their captors benefit from their free labor and keep their slaves ensnared through threats of harm or death, coercion, and drug addiction. Of course, child selling goes hand in hand with slavery, but there is just something that is unfathomable about parents selling their own flesh and blood into a life of forced servitude fraught with unimaginable suffering. There is nothing like the power of the almighty dollar. What's truly shocking is that the Internet is full of websites offering to take people's children in exchange for money. They try to dupe parents into thinking it's okay by claiming that it's better for the environment, touting some BS about population control, and posting pictures of smiling children who look like they are in summer camp and not coming off of an 18-hour shift at a sweatshop. It might surprise you to know that there are still groups of cannibals who still regard eating humans as part of their culture. For example, the Korowai people, located in Indonesia's New Guinea, admit that they still eat their human tribesmen. This tribe has a long tradition dating from prehistoric times of eating humans, and the fact that they have been relatively isolated from the modern world for so long has allowed this custom to remain. Today, their common human entree is a kahua, or witch doctor, whom they supposedly torture, kill, and eat. The first thing that comes to most people's minds when you mention human sacrifice is some group of ancient villagers throwing innocent victims into a volcano. But human sacrifices do not, in fact, exist today. For instance, discrete groups of Hindus still practice the neo-illegal tradition of shati. Shati is the funeral custom whereby a widow will throw herself, either willingly or due to social pressure, onto the pyre of her dead husband and burn to death. The women do it to show devotion and piety for their husbands. But in addition to being suicide or murder, the practice perpetuates female subordination. In 2011, a British broadcasting undercover reporter also discovered that child sacrifice had reemerged and developed into big business in Uganda's capital of Kampala. Wealthy people were paying witch doctors huge sums of money to sacrifice children, a ritual that some believed would bring them wealth and good health. The practice was so widespread that signs were put up warning parents and children about abduction by witch doctors. And in 2013, Miss Uganda joined the effort to stop child sacrifice, which she said was tearing the community apart. When America is constantly condemned and Africa held up as some model for humanity, these things need to be exposed. Prior to the 20th century, public executions were events considered fun for the whole family. But nowadays, not so much. In the Western world, they have mostly disappeared, and many nations are banning capital punishment altogether. But in some places, public executions never went away, and certain countries are relying on it more and more as a way to deter crime. Lately, the country making the most headlines with this practice of public executions is Iran. After experiencing an increase in violent crime, Iranian officials decided to move their hangings out from behind prison walls and into the Central Park in Tehran for all to see. These hangings involve hundreds of people a year. And just like the public executions, from centuries ago, people file in by the hundreds and jostle themselves for the best view. Convicts are executed for crimes like murder, rape, homosexuality, assault, and drug-related offenses. According to Amnesty International, only China executes more criminals than Iran. If there's one thing worse than a public execution, it's execution preceded by public torture. One of the most horrific ways to go is thought to be stoning, which involves burying people up to their waists or chests and bludgeoning them to death with rocks. And you would never hit the criminal with just the right-sized stones without it. Not too big, not too small, because they want you to kill the victim, not in one shot, or you could be convicted of a crime too. Currently, stoning is legal in Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Iran, and parts of Nigeria, and is typically used for the punishment of adulterers. But stoning just scratches the surface of all the lethal and non-lethal forms of punishment. In Nigeria, amputation for theft is perfectly acceptable. Flogging and caning are common occurrences in Singapore. And let's not even get into the horrifying forms of torture that are committed worldwide in the name of war. There's another shocking practice that cannot be left out when discussing barbarism. Avoiding any graphic details, it involves the surgical removal of all or part of a female's internal genitalia. It's mostly done in parts of Africa and the Middle East, and has cultural and religious backgrounds dating as far back as 484 B.C. As you've heard over the past 2 weeks of my commentaries, there is more than enough blame for slavery in the world and for barbaric practices to go around. Those who make excuses for Islamic extremism, or who fail to see the danger of it, are either terribly naive or politically motivated. Those who choose to continue portraying a false narrative about what slavery was all about have their reasons for keeping our people divided. The United States did not invent slavery. A relative few white people owned slaves in America, and those who did included black slave owners as well, and those black slave owners purchased white slaves as well as blacks. For the race hustlers among us, it is all about personal greed and money. For career Democrats, it is all about pacifying black people and the political plantations they created for that purpose. The driving force is votes. That is the same reason that Democrats fight against any move to restrict illegal immigration. Those immigrants are not doctors or scientists, but poor people, mostly uneducated, who understand this country's rules but are willing to disobey them because even the lowest paying job here is better than what they could earn in their own country. And besides, America offers benefits to legal and illegal immigrants not available in their home country. These people are vulnerable, and career Democrats see them as the path to the future for their party. Keep them dependent upon government, and they will vote to continue that government. All that I have told you in the past two Monday commentaries is true, but not being taught in our schools and universities that are dominated by liberal indoctrinaires. Instead, if you have white children, they are being taught to feel guilty about events that happened hundreds of years ago and far, far beyond their control. If your children are black, they're being taught that white people are guilty of enslaving your ancestors. white people, not all other races, creeds, and colors, who engaged in slavery, including blacks. They are being taught that white people owe them a debt, all white people, and that creates a climate of hate and division. Slavery was and is evil. But the idea that one certain group of people, white people, are more guilty than others is a myth. This is 2017, not 1840 or 1640. This country provides freedom and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness, not a guarantee. That goal requires personal responsibility, something that is in such short supply today. Ann and I are in Montana. We planned this trip some time ago, and I recorded my commentary of the last 2 weeks. We have been staying in Kalispell, Montana, at Glacier National Park, and enjoying what that vast countryside has to offer. The scenery is unbelievable. My two favorite states, as remote as they are Montana and Wyoming. If you get a chance to see either one, take it. We have enjoyed visiting there many times. But we had never been to the western side of Montana. It's over close to Spokane in Washington State. Absolutely beautiful. I'll be back next week, and God bless America.